Mr. Jack Edwards, Rail 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Edwards?
I was born on the 26th of February 1923 at a little place called Fox House, West Yorkshire, which is near home Firth, West Yorkshire. Only a little place, Fox House. It consists of a pub, our house, and a farm.
Can you tell us a bit about your background there?
Yes, well, my mother and father had married in 1921, and they moved into this little house which is next to the Fox House pub. And my father worked on the railway at Dumford Bridge, which was a mile and a half away. He previously lodged in Carlicoats, which is not far away, but when they married, they moved into this little house at Fox House. When I was four, that was in 1927, they managed to get a railway house in the village of Townhead, which was near Dumford Bridge. It was a railway-owned house, better than the one at Fox House, actually, because it had a water tap. Its own toilet and a water tap. And of course there's no gas or electricity in those days.
What was your life like? Was your dad in steady employment?
Yes, he worked steady railway. I suppose he was lucky in the 20s and 30s that he had a steady job on the railway. Not well paid, but he had a steady job.
And what about your brothers and sisters? Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have two sisters. One 2 years younger and one 4 years younger than I am. So we lived at Townhead, which was a tiny little village of railway houses, half a mile from Dumford Bridge, where there was a station, which was on the end, the Yorkshire end of the Woodhead Tunnel, actually, which was a busy line in those days. At Dumford Bridge, we had a coal yard, a good side is a coal yard, a pub, a little shop, and a railway station. And the railway station had a station master who lived in a house next to the station, and a porter. And the post office was, there was only one room at the station, the station master's office, and it was the station master's office, the booking office, and it was the post office as well. So the post, there was a young lady in there who ran the post office, and she would also give you tickets at the window.
Real village atmosphere then?
Yeah. I mean, it's strange. I mean, these days a little station wouldn't have a station master or a porter, would it?
And what about your education?
Well, we all went to the local village school, which was at Townhead. And when I was 10, I managed to pass the what was called a county minor scholarship, and so that I could go to Penistone Grammar School, which was 6 miles away. And I started there when I was 10 until I was 16.
How did you do at school?
Fairly well. I wasn't terrifically academic, but I was good at mathematics. I passed the school certificate in 1939, and beg your pardon, 38. Passed the school certificate in 1938. Sorry, and I got a distinction in mathematics, and a credit in chemistry, geography, and biology.
What about sport?
Well, at school we just did cricket and football, and I wasn't very great at either of them. But and we did PT, of course.
Did you have any hobbies outside of school? Big hobbies?
No.
Okay. And what were you aware? I mean, you're going through your school years. Were you aware of what was going on in Germany about Hitler, the coming war?
Well, vaguely, yes. We know there's always loads of trouble. I mean, partly because there was the Spanish Civil War to start with, and that was going on, and the Germans were taking part in that. And then the build-up to the war, of course, we knew what was going on, because they took over Austria, and took over a bit of Czechoslovakia, and then there was the trouble that they were wanting the Danzig corridor off Poland, so we knew there was trouble brewing.
You were actually following this in the papers, or?
Well, yes, as well as a young lad would do, but we knew what was going on.
Now,
but we didn't think there'd be a war, because we thought, well, they'll sort things out without a war, but there it was.
Had your dad been in the First World War?
Yes, he was in Highland Light Infantry from 1915 to 19.
Had he talked about it much to you? Or given
not
you
a lot, but he talked a little bit. He didn't talk a lot about it.
Now, what about you when you left school in 39? Was that before the war broke out? Or
just before I left in June, 30th of June 1939. Because in June 30th of June 1939, the family moved to Manchester. So there was very little work where I was. And my sister Marjorie, who was 14 at the time, was already in Manchester, lodging at our grandmother's and working at McVitie and Price's biscuit works in Stockport.
So you left school, you'd have left school round about then anyway, would you? Or would
no, because I was on a further year to take the matriculation. But as I say, the family moved and I came with them to Manchester and got work.
Now, what did you? Was there a question of you going back to school in Manchester or to school?
No.
So what work were you going to get? How did they get you in?
Well, my mother took me to the labour exchange and then they got me a job in a laboratory, which was a dyehouse laboratory in Droylsden here, Courtauld Limited.
And what were you doing in the laboratory?
We were doing sample dyings.
So a laboratory assistant?
A laboratory assistant, yes.
What did you think of the work?
Well, I wasn't very impressed to start with. It wasn't my idea of laboratory work, if you get me, coming from a grammar school where they had laboratories, and it wasn't that sort of a laboratory, if you get me, but it was a dyehouse laboratory, which there was a lot of good work went on there, but it wasn't such a sparkling laboratory as these places go.
So it was just a functional, you were testing the dyes to make sure they were right?
Oh, tested dyes, and we used to do sample dyings to provide recipes for the bulk dyeing. You see, all bulk dyeing, if it wasn't a stock shade, you had to have a recipe for it, which was nearly all three colour mixings, you see. When they dyed yarn, it was all three colour mixings to get the shade right. So you had to do a sample dyeing to get the percentages correct.
But not your cup of tea at the time. What about, do you remember the day war broke out?
Oh yes, I do. 3rd of September 1939, we were living in Manchester and my grandmother lived not far away and my youngest aunt, Auntie Edna, was still at home. So Auntie Edna came round, she was about, I was 16, she'd be about in early 20s, like 24 or 25. And she and me and my two sisters, we all walked in Crowcroft Park, which was nearby, and it was a sunny day, and all the barrage balloons were floating in the sky. They just put them up. And then at 11 o'clock we went back home to listen to the wireless, because we knew that Chamberlain was going to say something on the wireless, and they said we were now at war, so we thought, I'm blind, we were at war. So from then on the street lights were switched off.
How did you feel about it? I mean, you're 16, too young to be in it, but could be in it and were. How did you realise it might go on?
I haven't a clue in that respect. No, I didn't think it would probably go on that long, because I thought, oh, we've got all these marvellous aeroplanes and our good army and all that. I didn't think it would last more than a year or two. But
were you excited by the idea, or were you worried, or how did you feel?
No, I was excited. I mean, it wasn't my responsibility, and there's nothing I could do about it. So I thought, oh, you know, a bit of excitement. But I mean, it wasn't exciting for some people, obviously.
How did it affect your life then? Firstly, at work, did it affect what you were doing at Courtauld, the dye works?
Yes. Well, to start with, 2 or 3 weeks before the war started, everybody knew something was going to happen. So on the Saturday morning, all the men had to go and work. I mean, we normally work Saturday mornings anyway. All the men had to go and work and work on sandbags. And young lads like me and old chaps were filling the bags. And the other able-bodied blokes were stacking the bags to make blast walls and temporary shelters and things like that.
And then after that, did it affect the work you were doing? I mean, were you put on military jobs, dying?
Not immediately, no. As far as the work was concerned, it went on more or less normally for a couple of years, and then it started to change in that we started doing a lot of stuff like camouflage netting, dyeing for camouflage netting, and rot proofing netting, and rot proofing machine gun belts and things like that. And the Ministry of Labour got hold of the firm in 1942, that's after nearly 3 years, and said that they had to reduce staff, and then a gang of us, me included, had to go down to the Labour Exchange to be put on war work.
Yeah, I'll come back to that. So in the first couple of years, not much change. What about air raid shelters?
By the time the air raid started in 1940, our firm had had some air raid shelters built. They were sort of tubular concrete things, semi buried in the ground outside. So we had two good air raid shelters, which we used to go to every now and then when there was a siren in the daytime.
What was it like in there?
It was all right. we all gathered in. I mean, we didn't bother. We weren't frightened or anything, because although the sirens went, they didn't bomb near us.
What about shelter at home? Did you have an Anderson shelter?
No, we didn't have anything at home.
So, what did you do when the?
Well, I stayed in. The only when there were bad air raids, which was what they call Manchester Blitz, just before Christmas 1940. My mother and two sisters used to go to a factory, Meeson's factory, which is about 200 yards away, and they had a shelter in the basement.
What was it like in
there? On that particular night, I stayed in, because we had a dog, and I sat by the fire with the dog. I mean, the dog was all right. I was there with me, sort of hand on him.
And what was it like in the Manchester Blitz? Because it was quite a bad one, wasn't it?
It was pretty bad just for those two particular days. I mean, obviously there's odd bombs dropped on other times, but there were two nights of bad blood. Well, the first night of the Blitz, actually, I was at the time I was going to Manchester Tech in Manchester in the evening for evening school, and every time the sirens went, you had to get out or go in the shelter down below. Well, most of us got out and went home, you see. Well, in my case, it was a 5 mile walk home because the trolley buses stopped. When the sirens went, all the buses stopped, and on this route used to be trolley buses. And so I had to walk home, which was a 5 mile walk home, and I did that walk several times that autumn. And then just before Christmas, I did the walk home. I usually used to come up after New Road, which is probably the way you came on the taxi. Now, just for a change, it was throwing it down with rain, and I thought, for a change, I'll start off up the old road. I might get a bit more shelter going up the old road. So I went up the old road part way, and after about a mile and a half, I got to what was a cinema, which I can't. Oh, the Metropole Cinema. It's not there now. And they had a sort of it had been a theatre, and they had a veranda over. So I sheltered under that out of the pouring rain. And I looked to see what was on, and it was a film called Typhoon. So after a bit, I thought, I'll go in, it'll be warmer and drier now. So I went in and watched Typhoon, and while I was watching Typhoon, the guns started up outside, and they were banging away outside, and this Typhoon was raging on the film. Anyway, at the end of the film, I went out, and it just stopped raining away, but then the guns were blasting away like nobody's business, and I still had about another 3.5 miles home. So I carried on walking home, and every now and then when the guns went off overhead, I used to shelter in the doorway because the shrapnel used to come down, you see. I mean, if you got a piece of that on your head, you'd be a goner, I think. You used to hit the pavement with a terrific bang. So that was the first night of the Blitz. And the second night, as I say, I was at home, and I stayed in with the dog. And you heard when it went worse, because the gunfire would be overhead, if you get me. So you'd know there was something overhead. When it sounded at its worst, I used to go slight. We used to have a strong table, and the dog and I went under the table.
Was this actually one of the Morrison shelters, or was it just a strong table?
Just a strong table. No, Dad, it was an old-fashioned table with a thick oak top on it. I mean, it wasn't a very strong sort of house, if you get me, and I thought, well, better under there than anywhere.
Was there much damage, many bomb hits near you?
No, the nearest was at Clough Road, about 400 yards away. I mean, it sounded like the end of the street, if you get me. It was a hell of a bang. That was the nearest. I mean, there was others farther away.
And was it possible to get about Manchester the next day, you know?
I don't know. I think it was, because a friend of ours worked in Manchester, a young woman. She was a young woman then, with an office job, and she went to work, but when she got there, she couldn't get near the place, and the fireman said, "Oh, you can't do anything. It's not here anymore, you see." So it was still possible, but I mean, there must have been obviously places where you couldn't move.
And that was the worst of the Blitz, as far as
that was the worst. Yes, I say. I mean, they dropped a few bombs at other times, and planes used to go over no end, going to Liverpool. Let's see, how far away would it be? About a mile and a half away was a gun battery here, you see, and it used to belt away every night, and there used to be shrapnel falling all over the place. And but I mean, the planes very often were going over to Liverpool.
Now, were you a member of any of the volunteer organisations? I mean,
yes, in May 1940, they started the Home Guard, and the minimum wage was 17. Well, I was just a bit over 17, so I joined, and I was in it from more or less the start.
And did it have a name, the Home Guard? I mean, which one was it, or was it just...
I don't remember. It was the Droyles and Company of the Home Guard, but what name it was, I
Droyles and Company will do, yeah. And you joined in May 1940, and that was it, the local defence volunteers?
LDV it was called, and you just had a little armband with LDV on.
And can you give us an idea of what your service was like in the early days? Because there's all this thing about they didn't have any uniforms, didn't have any weapons. How did you get through that early bit?
Well, they only had enough rifles to start with, just for one night's guard, so we used to parade at Jordan Library. The particular night's guard, there'd be about 40 odd of us, I should imagine, to man four posts. And you'd have a rifle, and a section of 10 or 12 men would march off with a sergeant, and the sergeant had a bandolier with the ammunition. We all had an empty rifle, and he had the ammunition. And we manned four posts all night, just in civilian clothes with this armband on. My first night on guard, it was pouring with rain. I got absolutely soaked. I mean, the parachutists couldn't have come down in the pouring rain and the clouds. So they could have said, "Come in the guard room." That was 1940. Everybody was that frightened of somebody coming down out from the sky that you had to be on guard, even though it was pouring with rain.
And what about the other men? Were they all youngsters like yourself, or were there a mixture of
young and old? The oldest were like 40-odd ex-First Army men, and then there were youngsters and teenagers like myself up to 17, up to about 20.
I mean, how did the two ages get on?
Oh, quite well. My experience is that we got on quite well. I mean, the older chaps used to tell a few tales and say things like, "Oh, you'll always remember your first army, your first rifle number when you get in the army," things like that. So I did, and they used to call rifles bandooks and talk about chaff for the tea and things like that. So, I mean, do you know Dad's Army on the television? Corporal, what's he called?
Joe.
Corporal Jones. Well, in our section, we had a corporal, I can't remember his name.
Doesn't matter.
But it was a very similar, I mean, he wasn't as gormless as Corporal Jones, but he was similar build, and he'd been in the army in the Middle East in the First War, and he was always talking about Mespot, meaning Mesopotamia, and General Allenby, following General Allenby in Mesopotamia, and he was a bit like Corporal Jones in that respect.
Did they have any good, sound, practical advice that they'd give? Because they'd been trained, you hadn't, but well, you were, but I mean, did they give you any useful advice?
I don't remember, no. But just their...
Did you look up to them, or did you think they were daft old buffers?
Oh, no, I looked up to them, because, I mean, if there had been any action going, I think we'd have depended on them too, because I mean they were a bit more easy going than such as I was younger ones, steadier and easy going, I would imagine. And of course, such as the sergeants and officers had all seen action in the First World War, so they knew a bit about what it was about.
And t- tell me about your training. How did they take? How much drill did you do? And where did you do it?
We used to do some drill at the and various other training in the grounds at the Fairfield High School for Girls, which is about a mile away from here.
How did you take to drill? Foot drill.
Oh, all right. It took a bit of picking up. You used to have a blinking guard sergeant. You used to come and give us drill. But then our own NCOs who'd been on courses used to give us other training.
Did you find drill boring, or did you understand why you were doing it? Because a lot of young lads don't seem to know.
I didn't find it boring, no. I just took it as part of the business.
What about weapons training?
Yes, we did weapons training, rifle and bayonet, and that's all, because that's all we had to start with, and then we got a few other things, but they didn't concern us, rank and file, we just had rifles.
Did you actually get a chance to shoot your rifle? You know, to learn how to shoot?
Yes, well, in the first place, in 1940, during the summer, we hadn't enough ammunition to fire our own rifles. So there used to be a barracks at Ashton-under-Lyne up here, the Manchester Regiment barracks. And what they did, they took us to the Brushes Ranges, which is above Staley Bridge, a few miles away. And a truck came from the barracks with some of their army rifles and ammunition, and we fired the army rifles, the Shortley Enfields, which I thought were marvellous, because our rifles were old American First World War things, which were, to me were rather cumbersome. Whereas the Shortley Enfields were a beauty, very nicely balanced and so easy to use. And I thought, I felt like taking on the German army with a...
What about the kick?
With a short, like, well, they have a kick, but I mean, you talk to press it hard into your shoulder. If you don't press it hard, you get a kick, but it hurts as well.
Were you a decent shot, or...?
Oh, I was reasonable, yeah. I used to hit the bull a few times, and then... At a later date, when we got more ammunition, the following year we fired our own rifles at another range at Crowden, which is part way up towards Yorkshire. So, and then there used to be a sort of a funfair place in Manchester where they had a 2-2 range, quite a good 2-2 range, and I used to go and shoot there. I used to get good route from the 2-2.
What about bayonet fighting? Did they bother with that?
Not in the Home Guard, no.
So you just learnt basically shooting your rifle. Yeah. Any other training you got? So you've got drill, rifle.
A bit of field training.
What was that?
Fire and movement. One section firing while another section advances, and trying to make use of the cover what there was. And we once did a bayonet charge. Now I come to think, there's some fields over in Jolston. We did an advance across these fields, and for the last 100 yards, they said, gas mask, because you had to put your gas mask on, fix bayonets and charge, and we charged the last 100 yards, and we were gasping for breath and in a terrible state by the time we got there, because it's horrible running with a gas mask on.
Any other training, do you remember?
I think we did a night exercise once, and then Sunday mornings, lots of Sunday mornings we did exercises, attacking. And there's one big exercise once when the army was attacking Manchester and all the Home Guards were all defending their area.
What do you remember about that? That sounds interesting.
Not a lot. Except they came down the main Manchester road from Ashton, from Yorkshire area, from Yorkshire direction. And they were met at Drawsham Crossroads, which is called the Toll Bar. On top of the flat roof of the library were men with rifles, supposed to be potting at them. And other men in other positions with blanks, and they had bags of flour that they threw at them as imitation bombs. But they got through, obviously, because I mean that wouldn't stop them. But they got through, and I remember them. They were over. They came over Edgeley Bridge because I was at the HQ and I was sent on a recce to find out where they were, and we found them on Edgeley Bridge. I mean. A talk with a discussion with the umpires or something just over the Edge Lane Bridge here, which is a canal bridge. That's about all I can remember of that one.
And what about your duties? I mean, the first guards, you'd only had the, you know, four posts and things. How did the guard duties or the overnight guards develop? What were you guarding as well?
The four posts were all area, in areas where parachutists might land. There was one, ours was, well, difficult to describe now, but there's an isolated house and he had a garage which he didn't use, and the garage had some tubular electric heaters, and he let us use this for a guard room, and he was glad of it because it was such an isolated place and the bloke lived on his own, so he wasn't averse to having a bit of company all every night, you see. So that was our garden. There was fields all around, and we overlooked a railway into a valley, and on a clear night you got a good view. So and then other posts were similar. There was the Clough Road post, which was near the canal but next to fields. There was the what was called Land's End Farm, which is at Jordan Moor side, which covered the exits from what was then Ashton Moss, which was a large area of market gardening area. It's nearly all covered with motorway and such like now, but that was another area where parachutists could land. And the fourth post was actually near to the library, and it guarded the library because the library was the Civil Defence HQ.
Now, would someone on these posts have a Lewis gun or something like that, or is it just rifle fire?
We just had rifles. At a later date, by 1942, NCOs had Sten guns. But if there was any action, if we had to, if anything had happened, anything attack had developed, when we went to turn out to defend the place, there were seven platoons, you see, each platoon was a Knight's Guard, and six platoons had an area to defend, and one platoon would have been mobile.
And where was your...
Now the platoons that were in the defensive position, in some cases they had machine guns, because our position, which was at Draws and Moorside, covering a large area of fields, we had a Browning water-cooled machine gun besides our rifles. And two other of the platoons had a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle, which was a sort of light machine gun. That's the only ones we had apart from the rifle.
And who would use the Browning?
An NCO. A sergeant was in charge of the water-cooled Browning.
And so that would be where you'd go if the alarm was to go to your...
We had trenches dug ready, and that's where we would have gone if anything had happened. Obviously, I don't think Jordan was a very dangerous area in that respect. But, I mean, all over the country, people were like this, you see. They didn't know what would happen and where.
You don't seem to have had any of these impromptu weapons that they seem to have gone in for, these makeshift mortars and the rest of it, plane throwers.
I once saw a thing called an Northover projector, which was supposed to be for firing Molotov cocktails at tanks, but I saw one and somebody told us a bit about it, but we didn't have any.
When you're on guard once a week from the sound of it.
Yes, we did Monday night.
We expected to go to work.
Yes, well, I used to finish guard. You used to do a lot of marching, because I used to march from home to the guard room to the HQ, which is about a mile and a half. Then we'd pick our rifles, march to the post, which is about another mile and a half, and in the morning, sometime after six, we'd march back to the HQ to hand in the rifles, and I'd walk home a mile and a half. So I used to do about 6 miles just to do the guard.
And then to work?
Then I'd have my breakfast and go to work, yeah. Well, everybody did that, so you were all a bit short of sleep.
And that's all you were in? You weren't in any of the ARP parts?
No. Well, that was pretty well enough, you see.